Hello, you are listening to They Came From the North, which is your weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, bi-monthly, yearly, semi-annual...
autobiographical.
At least once a solstice podcast. by Canadians, for Canadians, and Americans, and Europeans, and, well, wherever else you may hail from. We
represent all of humanity.
We are a global podcast. Because this is the world, not one country. Together,
we are the world.
Never do that again. With me tonight, from Crom's Misty Realm, I've got Mr. John Mercer.
Crom.
From a not so misty realm, but probably kind of smoggy and rainy realm, I've got Mr. Gabriel Girard.
Bonjour.
And joining us from, I have no idea where, because I wasn't paying attention.
Moose Jaw, California.
Moose Jaw, California. Okay. From Moose Jaw, California, I've got Mr. Cameron, and I've forgotten how to pronounce his last name already, because that's how I roll.
It's Cloutier. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Tonight, we will be tackling the sometimes controversial... once upon a time prolific, but not so much in the last, 20 years, Mr. John Milius. He is, of course, well known as what he called, or what he often referred to himself as a Zen fascist, or American samurai. He got his start early on as a writer rather than a director, around the mid-60s. He took a job writing for some TV shows, graduated into film, eventually wound up, you know, having some success with some Dirty Harry movies, this little Clint Eastwood picture, like revenge movie or something where he plays a cop or some stuff. I don't know. Apparently they were really popular back in the day with the kids, you know. For the first Dirty Harry, he went uncredited, I believe, and was actually paid by being given an expensive gun.
True.
He... went behind the camera when he was offered Dillinger by American International Pictures, based on a screenplay that he actually wrote. A very, for the time, we'll say, violent and cathartic action picture that kind of retold the story of John Dillinger.
Can I just add something? Very reminiscent of Peckinpah, I thought.
Oh, big time. Big time. Yeah. For sure. You can see Peckinpah, like his influences there, and of course Sergio Leone as well. He then moved into an adventure film starring Sean Connery as the most unlikely Berber imaginable, The Wind and the Lion. Then there was an autobiographical surfing picture called Big Wednesday, which didn't really do much, but it has moved on to become somewhat successful in, you know, cult film circles, like most surfing movies do. Right around the same time, actually a little earlier, I should say, he gained a lot of notoriety, I guess, with two friends and compatriots, Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas, when the three planned to make a Vietnam film called Apocalypse Now, based on Conrad's Heart of Darkness. The pitch was that Milius would write and produce, George Lucas would direct, and both men would actually fly to Vietnam and shoot the film on location during the closing years of the Vietnam War. For insurance reasons, it didn't pan out, surprisingly. Is anybody really shocked at this, you know?
No, but they were going to shoot it in 16 millimeter.
His friendship with George was long-lasting, and, I mean, that whole crew, you know, the American Zoetrope guys, Francis Ford Coppola, Spielberg, Lucas... he's still kind of a fixture in that group, and one of Spielberg's favorite anecdotes is, you know, he's on the set of Saving Private Ryan filming the D-Day invasion, and he actually has to pick up a phone immediately and call John Milius because he is dressed as a German in a bunker shooting whatever it was those machine guns were at American soldiers as they ran up the Normandy beach kind of thing, you know, and he's there with a cigar in his mouth talking to Milius. It's like, you would love this. You would love this. And Milius's response was like, why didn't you invite me kind of thing? yeah, he went on to, some success as an action director. He did, of course, the extremely popular for its time and kind of vanished for a little while and came back again, Conan the Barbarian. He had Red Dawn in 1984, which was kind of a Cold War, you know, fear-mongering kind of movie about communist agents invading the United States.
It was our Hunger Games, goddammit.
He had Farewell to the King with Nick Nolte and Flight of the Intruder, which was an adaptation of a pretty popular little military, you know, Tom Clancy-esque novel that took place during the Vietnam War and focused on intruder bomber pilots. After that, he kind of disappeared. He has done a few little odds and sods here and there. He was involved in HBO's television series Rome, most notably. He directed the pilot episode and was involved as a creative consultant and an advisor for the majority of the series. He was a story consultant for the video game Homefront, which was kind of a like 21st century retelling of Red Dawn to an extent, with a lot more explosions and gunfire. And he was initially involved with a relaunch of Conan the Barbarian starring Arnold Schwarzenegger back in like the, I think it was in the early 2000s, called King Conan, Crown of Iron. That script is out there online if you want to seek it out. It was actually pretty awesome and would have been a pretty cool, I guess a pretty cool reboot slash reimagining of Conan without ruling out Conan the Barbarian back in 82. But sadly, Arnold ran for governor and the movie just never came to pass. It was right on the verge, apparently, and then vanished. Which leads us to today, I guess. I don't think I've left anything out. Some made-for-TV movies.
Have you seen the documentary yet about him?
Milius, I haven't, no.
Okay, if you don't mind, I can just add like one couple quick points.
Go for it.
Okay, well, this is something that I didn't know about because it's not on the internet or anything. But so I'm watching this documentary about Milius, and I'm thinking, well, this would be great, you know, because so many of these guys have had other documentaries made about them. And I thought, you know, it'd be really cool that Milius gets his own. And so I'm watching it, and I'm like, okay, they're touching on this film. They're talking about this. And they're using this interview from 2009 or 10, I believe. And I'm thinking, okay, this is weird because they interviewed him. But maybe he just gave a great interview, and so they didn't need to re-interview him again for the documentary. Well, it turns out that he was going to make King Conan. He was going to make this film about Genghis Khan, but then he had a stroke. And he's been... And he's been even though he is recuperating, he has basically lost his voice. He can type, but he can't talk, and he can, you know, he has trouble typing and that type of thing. The documentary concludes with him smiling because he relearns how to go skeet shooting. And so it leaves you kind of happy, but at the same time, though, it's just, you know, it's, you know, I had no idea, and so you see this guy who's so bombastic and hilarious, in my opinion, in interviews. And then you see him basically shaking, trying to relearn how to do the ABCs on an iPad. It really breaks your heart. So I'm really glad we're talking about this guy today because I think that he is kind of an unsung hero to a lot of people in the film community.
Agreed. Those of you who've been listening for a while, you know the rules. We run down.
There are none.
Yeah. Don't fuck around, fellas. You all know the rules, and you know I won't stand for it. goods, bads, and uglies. We talk our best, our well-liked but possibly flawed, and our just generally reviled and hated or whatever films by our chosen director. We're going to start with the good of John Milius, and we're going to start with Mr. Gabriel Girard, because I haven't heard your pleasant voice in a few weeks, Gabe.
Well, for my good, I went... I could have gone with Conan, which is, you know, really, really amazing. But the movie to me that really felt the most complete of Milius's was Farewell to the King, which is about this about Nick Nolte, who gets stranded on I don't remember, like Thailand or something, during Second World War II. Or is in Borneo, like on one of these island places, and he becomes the king of the indigenous people, and then the Brits come in the island and want to get him to participate into fighting against the Japanese. It's a very, very good looking adventure piece with a lot of good character moments. A great performance by Nick Nolte, who was very kingly and carries that off well. A lot of the themes that Milius cherishes with honor and manliness and respect for your fellow being human beings. And what I like the most about it is most of his movies feel kind of episodic to me, and this is the one that I felt told the most complete story, that felt the most fulfilling as a story. I know, like, he's talking about it and said that he didn't agree with the editing or anything, but I didn't see any of that. It felt pretty perfect to me.
I found what I really liked about Farewell to the King, you know, it's got that real, that boy's own feel to it. You know, like, and I don't mean that it feels like a man's movie or a testosterone-fueled action fest. It feels like, you know, like Jack London or something like that, you know. It's got that real adventure, you know, boys adventure movie feel to it. And some of the sequences in it, like some of those set pieces, man, are amazingly well mounted. Like the big, there's a big showdown in like a forest. And, you know, you got guys on horseback and you got explosions going off. And it felt huge. It felt so epic. It was a great movie. And then it ends on kind of like this such a down note, not to spoil anything, but, you know, like it does have a bit of a downer of an ending, but then there's that sense of hope right before the credits roll, you know? And it's just like, man, like, when it was over, it's one of those movies that when it was over, I felt like $1 million, you know? Yeah. Like I really felt like, man, that was just a great ride, you know? And that to me is something that Milius does pretty well anyway. Like he does that, you know, that sense of adventure, I guess, is what it is. He does that really, really well. He did it pretty well in The Wind and the Lion as well, but there's something about Farewell to the King and the fact that, you know, I've always liked Milius, I've always known his name, and I've always kind of followed him, but until, like, probably 2 months ago, I had never seen that movie, you know? And it was just, like, not even realizing that it existed, and then sitting down and watching, I was like, my God, this movie is freaking great, you know?
Yeah, it's one of these movies that you discover, and you're like, where has this movie been my whole life?
Yeah, like, why doesn't anybody know about this movie?
Yeah.
Well, the movie was kind of written off, I remember, even at the time, because a lot of the criticisms, and not just from critics, but from average moviegoers, they were going, well, this looks like, you know, a scaled-down version of Apocalypse Now. And so it got a lot of, like, bad flack for that. Also, you know, this was still, I mean, even though he's still an acclaimed actor, this was still around the time where, you know, people weren't sure whether to entirely trust Nick Nolte in a native performance. I just remember just the terrible time that movie had finding an audience, because it just felt like Milius's original script for, you know, Apocalypse Now with Kurtz, and just redoing it, but in a much more, I thought, in a better way than when Malick did it with Jim Caviezel in The Thin Red Line, that little subplot. It just seemed a little, you know, better.
Yeah, definitely. I guess, like, a lot of it, too, like, I mean, you compare it to The Thin Red Line, and that's a pretty interesting comparison. But, you know, it's developed a very different way from what Malick did with The Thin Red Line. You know, like, Malick is just such a bizarre cat when it comes to character development. Like, he's not interested in character development. Malick doesn't do characters. You know, he does these tone poems, and he does narrative, but he doesn't do character. Whereas Nolte in this movie really felt like a character, you know, like he really felt not necessarily well developed, but he had a strong persona.
And the main British guy too really feels like a character. If you want to compare it to Apocalypse Now, the Martin Sheen character in that he never really feels developed or anything. He's just there to make the action happen.
Yeah.
Well, the British character in Farewell to the King really feels like a living character, and you see him falling in love with this guy, you know, really being under the power of the Nolte, of his essential dignity.
Yeah, really caught it. Like, you know, you had Kurtz was an ugly human being. Kurtz was, you know, Sheen finds Kurtz, and Kurtz corrupts him, you know, makes him, you know, like he sees the dark side of humanity in Kurtz, whereas, you know, this British officer sees hope and sees humanity in Nolte's character, mm-hmm. you know, and that kind of, that plays out completely differently, but it's like, again, it's a good comparison. I mean, you know, it's a really good comparison to Apocalypse Now, but they're completely different movies, right?
Yeah.
You know?
It's funny to me that that you guys did Borman just before, because this kind of feels like a John Borman movie.
It does,
movie
yeah, too. And like, it could almost kind of go in there with The Emerald Forest or something like that, you know? Like, it's got that same kind of, you know? It's not, it's far better than The Emerald Forest, but, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, we don't have Borman's son in this one.
No.
But, yeah, I mean, it is a very, very good, entertaining movie that I think deserves a wider audience.
I agree completely. I think it would look absolutely amazing on Blu-ray. You know, a nice high-definition treatment would look phenomenal.
I mean, I watched, the only way I could find it was on streaming on Amazon. and it still looked good.
Yeah, I watched a Euro DVD.
You know, I mean, what's really interesting is that, you know, in the heyday of DVD in the late 90s, early 2000s, when you had people like Herzog and John Carpenter's films, the reasons why those got rediscovered is because they were widescreen, there was great commentaries, behind-the-scenes stuff. The problem with Milius's films is there's not a lot of that stuff on his movies, so they just kind of get buried under like a Warner Archive edition. You know, they don't really do special editions for you to, you know, rediscover these films in big ways, you know. So I think something like Farewell to the King deserves to have sort of like a Criterion treatment to it, and then people would really love it, you know.
Yeah, and it is, you know, like, in all honesty, it's deserving of it. And I mean, I'm not just saying that as some John Milius nutbar who, you know, yes, I am a John Milius nutbar, but at the same time, I'm not saying it because of my love for Milius. I just think it's a fantastic movie.
It truly is. And it's nice to see Nick Nolte give that kind of nuanced performance, too. He tends to go, you know, pretty big, and it works for him. But this character is something different than we're used to see from him.
Yeah, and then the next year he would do Cape Fear. So, I mean, it shows that the guy has talent, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Who wants to go next? Cameron, would you like to go next?
Sure. My Good is actually a little-known film that Milius did. He actually did it for TV. It's a TNT film, but it is a three-hour film that's released as one film on a DVD, and that is called Rough Riders. And it stars Tom Berenger, Sam Elliott, and one of his favorites, Gary Busey. So, and it's you know, one of the things that I know we were trying to pick different goods, and you know, so we didn't have too much crisscross. But one of the reasons why I picked it is because this is the last film that Milius has directed so far. It came out in 1997. And again, I mentioned the stroke that he had in 2010. But for some reason, you know, ever since Red Dawn, it became harder and harder for him to get money to make a film. But this film, what I like about it so much is it chronicles Theodore Roosevelt in his early days as he's trying to create this volunteer militia unit called the Rough Riders to fight in the Spanish-American War. But what's nice about it is it kind of combines so many themes of Milius's work into one film. You have, you know, he dealt with Theodore Roosevelt a little bit in The Wind and the Lion. You know, he's a big historical buff. Whenever there's, like, if you even look, not just the films he's directed, but the films he's written or advised on, he's been a major voice in a lot of the American films being made about war. He certainly knows his way around that. So I don't know. I just really respect the fact that you know, a lot of his TV work just feels like for hire, but this feels like he really took it under his wing, and he tried to make an American epic for TV. This movie came out around the same time that TNT was doing their other films like Gettysburg and Gods and Generals and stuff like that. But this, to me, feels very I know this is from They Came from the North, but this film feels like so, like, American, you know?
It does, really, for sure.
Yeah, and to think that it was originally going to be directed by Hugh Wilson, who made Police Academy, it just makes me respect it that much more. So, yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to say. I mean, it is what it is, but you know, Sam Elliott, you know, on the set of this film was being interviewed about Milius, and he just said, you know, John Milius doesn't make films about pussies or women. He makes films about men.
I remember that, and, was I think one of the clip. That's the clip that starts off the Milius documentary, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and I can't think of anything better to begin a film like that. And any DVD cover that has Tom Berenger with the gun shooting at you, dressed up as Teddy Roosevelt, can't be that bad. So that's. I mean, I think it's worth checking out. And also, it's got actually a commentary by Milius on there. And as somebody who just loves hearing that man talk, him talking for 3 hours about Teddy Roosevelt and the Spanish-American War, I could listen to that all day long.
I still remember that this I remember when I was a teenager, it was on TNT, right?
Right.
Yeah, no, I can remember that this was advertised pretty much nonstop during episodes of WCW Nitro. And it just, like, you wouldn't believe, and I mean, Milius talks about, you know, how much the executives at Turner and everyone hated him.
Right.
Because he, you know, he stepped in and they set all these edicts for him, and he basically just bulldozed right past everything.
Right.
Because, I mean, Milius is the Teddy Roosevelt of filmmakers. And it's just, who else would shoot a 4-hour-long TV miniseries and have it come out feeling like I would have paid to have seen Rough Riders in theater.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that good of a movie. And it's just one of those things you're watching. It's a TV movie. It's like, how did they get this cast? I mean, you're looking at, what do you got? You got Tom Berenger, Sam Elliott, Gary Busey. Brian Keith is in it. I think Brian Keith played Teddy Roosevelt in The Wind and the Lion. He's playing William McKinley in this movie. Ermy, Dale Dye, Holt McCallany, Jeffrey Lewis, who's a guy I love, doesn't show up in enough stuff. Fucking Nick Chinlin is in this movie. Have you ever seen this, Steve?
I own it, but I don't know where my copy is.
Rough, I mean, badass.
I've had it for men. I've had it since, like, the Glen Hill days. But I can't.
I remember this was one of the ones, it was, used to be in a VHS fanny pack. It was 2 tapes.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I had it on DVD. It was a 2-disc set, I believe. And I'm not sure if I loaned it to somebody or what, but I have no idea what happened to it. I thought I'd given it to Dad, but when I went through all the Dad stuff, it wasn't there. So, who knows?
Brian.
No, I don't think it was Brian. Brian wouldn't have had any interest in it, so. Great movie, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those, you look at it and it's like, I can't believe this is a TV movie.
And every time Milius makes a film, I'm always surprised he doesn't have another film in the wings. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, he has to go back to, like, writing for hire. And it's just, it's very sad because every film he makes, maybe with the exception of a couple we'll discuss on here, but I would say for the most part, he's one of those filmmakers that if he gets the job to make a film, you feel like he puts everything of himself into that film because he doesn't know when the next one's going to come along.
Definitely buy that, yep.
Yeah. And, you know, he's also one of those filmmakers that, you know, we're talking about goods and bads and uglies, but he's one of those filmmakers, and it's a rare list that any one of us could pick, I would say, 99% of the films on his, the films that he's made, and I don't think we're going to disagree too much about why we pick that as our good, because it's just, you know, he's that good of a filmmaker, in my opinion. Mm.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, John, I guess me and you probably picked the same film, did we?
Oh, you're damn right we did.
I figured I'd save us for last, because I kind of figured that was going to happen.
Before you announce it right away, it's just, I had to pick, it's one of these movies, there's movies that I like, and there's movies that I love, and then there's movies that change your fucking life.
Yeah.
Right, there's ones that you just, you know, the movie, it's got this symbiotic relationship with you. You know, it's one of those things. I have watched it into the triple digits. Every time I was sick growing up, it was the VHS tape that went in the VCR. Whenever I had, you know, back when I was a teenager and we used to get days or Saturdays or Sundays when it was just pissing down rain, I wasn't going out anywhere, so I just threw up my sketchbook and drew all afternoon. This was the movie that was on in the background.
Yeah, with me, it was very, very similar. Probably that mixed with Willow. But we're talking Conan the Barbarian. There's just, you know, two things I'll get out of the way right off the bat. As a Robert E. Howard fan and someone who's read every single one of Howard's Conan stories, it is not a good adaptation of Robert E. Howard at all, period. And, you know, whatever. It's a shitty, terrible adaptation of the source material. And Arnold Schwarzenegger is not the ideal choice for Conan at all, period, full stop. However, the fact that Arnold has made that character so iconic and has associated himself so much with Conan in popular culture, that says everything that needs to be said about how well executed that movie was. You know, people hear Conan the Barbarian now, they think Arnold. They don't think, you know, obscure pulp writer from 1920s America. You know, they think Arnold Schwarzenegger immediately. You know, and
they don't think Jason Momoa.
They definitely don't think Jason Momoa. You know, definitely do not. And you know what Milius and I mean what he did with Stone Script for starters, and then what he created. I mean, he took the biggest kind of pulp fantasy and turned it into a, like, shot it like an art film. Mm-hmm. That movie is just so beautifully textured and so beautifully shot. Like his use of light, the technical aspects of the film, unbelievable. The effects and like the fight choreography and stuff. Effects, yeah, there's some stuff that's dated, you know, like James Earl Jones turning into a snake is kind of lame these days, but just what he...
How else were you going to do that in 1982?
Exactly. And how he managed to pull all of this stuff off. I think like when they were over in Spain or wherever it was, Cinecita or wherever it was they filmed it, I think they just hired people and got Arnold to cut him open. You know, I think they just took bums and said, here's a bottle of cheap wine. Now Arnold slash this guy, you know, like.
I'm still wondering if he really punched that camera.
Oh, he totally did.
And if I was riding into battle for whatever reason, if we were ever at war, I'd want Basil's score pumping into my ear the whole time.
My God, man. The Anvil of Krom. Yeah, and what was the second
one? We promised Forbes we'd... my personal favorite on it is Theology and
I know the one you're talking about, when the two of them are having their little debate about gods and stuff, yeah.
And the fireplane, and it cuts to the what basically became the Conan and Subotai theme.
Yeah, like it's almost like it's a joyful little melody, right?
Yeah, when they're running through this just endless Elysian field, you know, towards I forget which town they end up in first, Zamora, and it plays in again when Subotai rescues Conan off the Tree of Woe.
Yeah.
And there you go. There again, this is just how great this movie is. It popularized a term like Tree of Woe. It is endlessly quotable, and just everything about the movie oozes both epic and cool.
Mm.
It's just, yeah. It's
a painting come to life.
It has this unique feel to it. There's no other movie out there that feels like it at all. You know, I mean,
no.
From the sequels to all of the ripoffs that came after it, nothing out there feels like Conan. I mean, the closest comparison I could give it, and even that is completely different, and again we go to Borman, is Excalibur. And even then, that is completely different, you know, but that's the closest in tone and in feel that I could...
The most surprising thing to me about it is definitely the atmosphere. You know, the fact that he decided to just pare it down, and you know, he's kind of shooting as if you're in a dream.
Yeah,
it puts you in a trance. You know, you're expecting this big stupid action movie. You know, when you see the poster or whatever, but this is, like you said, Steve, it's an art flick.
Yeah. Yep.
It puts you under the spell, you know, just from the first, let me take you back to the days of high adventure, you know?
Dun, 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 dun.
No, for me, guys, it's even right at the very first rumble of the beginning of Anvil of Krom, when the Nietzsche quote comes up on screen.
Yes. You know,
that which does not kill us, it can only make us stronger.
Yeah.
And it's, it's just, the movie's absolutely hypnotic to watch. Layered and beautiful, yet at the same time, shockingly violent.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And, I mean, the violence comes in these really, really quick spurts.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, it is shockingly violent, and there's some big scenes, but it's,
no, but
it's
I mean,
not
the,
an
the
action
sword choreography. No, not at all. The sword choreography in it, though, I mean, when the swords come out, it's always just these quick flourishes and, like, beautiful, beautiful slash. It looks, you know, the swords aren't, the guys aren't clashing swords off of one another.
No.
I don't think there's anyone in the movie Conan doesn't kill in under 2 seconds. And right? When push comes to shove.
I think, too, that, like, you see a lot of early to mid-period Kurosawa, too, in the way he choreographs the fights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see you see a little bit of Seven Samurai in there. You see a little bit of, you know, like, that era of Kurosawa on the screen, you know?
Well, I mean, especially when you look back at, you know, him coming out of the American Zoetrope crowd, how much Kurosawa he and Lucas went to watch in theaters and that together.
Yeah,
and also due to some of the effects he did, and just the feeling, it brought me back to like Jason and the Argonauts.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's where Conan belongs, is with these grand epics, right? Conan, it's one of those movies it belongs in the same breath as stuff as Ben Hur and what were the other couple of Heston ones we were talking about.
El Cid and stuff like that.
Yeah, Conan is just, and even for something that's got such a simple story to it, it's the movie feels huge.
And I mean, I'll say it, like, I mean, it's not going to be a popular opinion, and I mean, if Forbes was here now, he'd be like, oh, come on, you know, if I say this, but as unprofessional as, say, Arnold and Sandal Bergman and what was the guy who played Subotai? Surfer Dude?
Jerry Lopez.
As unprofessional as the three of those guys were, they were so goddamn earnest and so invested in that movie. I look at them and I compare them to, say, Charlton Heston and El Cid, and you know what? They do just as good a fucking job in that movie. You know? Ben-Hur, okay, yeah, Heston owns Ben-Hur, but, you know, you look at him in a lot of his lesser stuff, and Heston is pretty hammy, man. He's pretty cheesy, you know? And these guys, they felt almost more earnest and more really invested. And that's something you can't say about Arnold very often. You know, Arnold is usually playing the persona of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Hollywood star, you know? Whereas in Conan, I mean, he was young, he was hungry, and he was invested in that movie. Is he a great actor? No. But man, was he ever invested in it, you know?
Well, man, he makes that character into a... Conan feels like an adolescent wolf, right?
Yeah.
He's inquisitive, and he's carrying these wounds around with him the entire movie. Yet, you know, it's as you learn as the movie goes on, you know, he becomes a cornered animal, and that's the most dangerous thing in the world.
Yeah,
right. And it all comes through in just these, like, these guys were they weren't good actors. But I mean, the dialogue they're delivering is just, it makes them sound like a million bucks.
Yeah, and that's the other big thing is his script, man. Like, I mean, no, it's not a faithful adaptation, but what he did with it, like how he added his, like he weaved his own philosophy in and out of that movie so effortlessly. You know, like, it's very much a John Milius movie. Like, it very much goes into his worldview and his mindset, you know. He does that with that movie absolutely brilliantly. And I don't know if you've ever read the original script or not, the Stone script, but that was a pile of garbage. That was refuse, man. That was terrible.
Well, what that Oliver Stone script was a guy flicking through the old Roy Thomas Marvel comics and then
snorting a lot of coke.
Right, just going on a cocaine binge and just throwing together this crazy, crazy fever dream.
Yeah.
Milius' movie feels like you said, like an art film. It's a goddamn samurai epic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even just the fact that Conan has to think strategically, you know, in order to win, that he has to build those contraptions instead of just using a sword.
There's more to it. There's a bit more substance to it, you know? It feels a little bit more like a lived-in world. It feels more, you know, like this is a realized place rather than just, you know, let's shoot what works best in the confines of a screenplay, you know?
Yeah, I almost love how there's no, you know, besides the fact Thulsa Doom wiped out his village when he was a kid, but I mean, there's no, like, grand confrontation of ideals between him and False of Doom.
No.
You know,
straight off.
For all intents and purposes, Doom is right. He figured out the riddle.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, when he comes with Conan at the end of the movie, it's just a fact, you know, it's the old lion versus the young lion, right? Yeah. He came up, you know, every warrior eventually comes up against a sword they can't block against, yeah. Right?
Steel is strong, but yeah. Flesh is stronger, you know?
Yeah.
I'll leave on one last note. I can't talk about Conan the Barbarian without mentioning James Earl Jones' absolutely fantastic performance. And, of course, one of the most memorable cameos in history with Max von Sydow as yes. King Osric.
I'm glad they cut out his death scene.
Yeah, yeah, I am too, actually.
Yeah.
I think but it would have diminished his character some.
I think a couple of quick things. I think any movie that begins with something called the Wheel of Pain just declares itself a masterpiece.
And just well, the Wheel of Pain, and they don't tell you what the fuck that thing does. Well, why is it there? Is it like a water pump? Are they grinding grain with it? No, they're making Arnold Schwarzenegger. Right, and it's just I love the look of everything. We didn't even get on how great looking the sets are.
Mm-hmm.
You know that. I mean, again, most of the sets in are just wide open Spanish plain. But I mean, when they get into like when you see the gladiator pit or the cage they keep Conan in whatever city he's in at this point, when he's still the slave gladiator, and the snake towers, and mm-hmm. I forgot the mountain of power is amazing.
And it was all built. I mean, you know, at the end of the movie, when you see the Mountain of Power burning, it's because it's actually burning.
Yeah, they dismantled that set.
They did. Apparently, it was unintentional, but it worked. You know.
Hey, Arnold, the stunt guy say you can't actually hammer throw this burning oil pot 30 yards. Really?
I also loved how in the extended version of the DVD, they changed the ending scroll to say, you know, he became a king by his own hand, and this story will also be told. I remember just jumping out of my chair clapping because I was like, yes, it's coming, the third one. And that has yet to be seen. I remember...
Yeah, that extended cut, that's my preferred way to watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the stuff with... you know, I love the... just that Conan's not changing the world, right? He's not, you know, he hacked down one tyrant, but he's not changing anything. You know, the princess is still throwing herself prostrate at the feet of another ruler,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, I do love the fact that they didn't put back in Osric's death scene because that kind of renders the whole movie moot. You know, what are they even?
Why are they even going bothering? And you know? Yeah,
yeah. Why are they even bothering? And but I mean, there's a great scene in the extended cut with Conan and Subutai sitting down just before the final battle.
Yeah,
and it's some of the best acting of Schwarzenegger's entire career. I always say the best two things, the best three things Arnold Schwarzenegger ever did were his entire performance in True Lies is fantastic because it's making fun of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah,
the video camera neck turn from the Terminator. And he moves his neck very slowly, and then he moves his eyes to...
Yeah, the robotic turn kind of thing.
Yeah, all his movements in the Terminator. And this one scene in Conan where he and Subutai are sitting down, and he's reminiscing about his childhood.
Yeah.
Of what he can remember from his childhood. And, you know, he talks about how instead of a full childhood, he had 20 years of pitiless combat.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're... there is no summer for men like us, Subutai. Just the calm before the storm, or no spring for men like us.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the calm that comes before the storm. And Subutai gets a great line in there too. The Conan apologizes for bringing him there, or they're talking about, you know, the chance they might die there, and he says you'd only lead me back here another day in even worse company.
Yeah, yeah.
And just it's goddamn poetry, right?
what's really interesting about this film is, you know, after this film came out, there were a slew of PG-rated fantasy films that came out, and including the sequel, Conan the Destroyer, which I know blasphemy was because I was like a 9 years old kid. That was the one I saw first, right? And so I really liked Conan the Destroyer when I was 9 years old. And then my mom goes, oh, I rented you Conan the Barbarian. This is the first one. And I remember putting it on. And, we, you know, you guys talk about the violence. The thing that shocked me, because I was 9 years old, was the sexuality of the film. I was not prepared for a naked woman to be brought into his cage, you know, yeah. where he was being held. And I just remember going, I don't know if I should be watching this, because the what's so strange is...
They're not shy about women's breasts in this movie, are they?
No. But coming off the tone of only seeing the second one first when you're a little kid, the first one's tone is so... It's stark, it's surprising, it's... You know you're in a – you know a different filmmaker made this movie.
Well, I mean, the second one is definitely an adaptation of the Marvel comics. You know, like the second one is – and I don't hate it for that. You know, like I don't hate Conan the Destroyer. I think it's an entertaining film in its own right. Some of the effects work is absolutely terrible, yes. And, you know, it is more than a little cheesy at times. But as an adaptation of what Marvel was doing with the comics in the 70s and the early 80s, and, of course, the 80s being – what they were, Conan was one of the books that I read. You know, Conan was one of my big comic books. So seeing Conan the Destroyer, like, and see at a young age especially, it was 86 that came out or 85?
Did you ever have any of the big oversized... I remember Conan used to come in these, instead of regular size comics, they also had these great big...
Black and white magazines.
It was still
Savage Sword.
It was still comics, but they were just massive magazines.
Yeah, Savage Sword of Conan.
You ever have any of that?
Man, there's a bunch of them floating around Mom and Dad's house somewhere. Kev's got a bunch of those, too.
I remember Kev talking about him,
yeah. Well, yeah, and I mean, like, I was into Conan from the Marvel scene, like, in the Marvel universe kind of thing, so seeing the Destroyer was like, hey, this is great kind of thing, you know, and Conan the Barbarian was one of those movies that I was young when I discovered it, but I had seen Destroyer first as well. I had seen Destroyer in theater, I believe.
And I hadn't seen Destroyer first. You want to know what my first experience was of Conan the Barbarian?
What's that?
Red Sonja.
Oh,
Red Sonja was when Dad used to go down to Mrs. Hamlin's, go down to Red Circle Video, and they had their three movies for 4 days for $5 was their deal, right? Yeah. And Dad would go down to the weekend, and he'd rent three movies all the time. And I always make this joke because Dad, 8 weekends in a row, brought home Raw Deal with Arnold Schwarzenegger, thinking he'd found a new Schwarzenegger movie for us to watch. And we'd get to the beginning of it, and the Jeep chase would start, and he'd be like, motherfucker. but I remember I saw Red Sonja first, and being, you know, the child that was in the 80s, absolutely loved it. And, you know... This was back in the. This is how Red Sonja led to me seeing stuff like Conan the Barbarian and Deathstalker and all the other horrible Beastmaster and, you know, anything. It's like, you know, after you see the Terminator, you want anything, any movie that had a guy in sunglasses with a big gun on the cover, you rent it. after Red Sonja, anything that had, you know, muscles and swords on the cover went home with us.
Yeah.
And. But I mean that led to me seeing Conan the Barbarian, and again, it's one of those movies that changed my life. Right, turned me from being just a guy who liked movies to a guy who watches movies and picks up on, you know, who the cinematographer is.
Yeah, and geeky things and shots.
And let it be said that, you know, the reason why this movie came out so good. And why it seems so much just like a full John Milius vision is because he didn't have to answer to a studio or Hollywood. He had to answer to one guy, Dino De Laurentiis, who loved him.
Yeah.
So he let Milius do whatever he wanted.
Who was terrified of him. This guy is the biggest Americanist man I've ever seen.
I love you, you crazy bastard.
Is this where the Arnold Schwarzenegger story comes from, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why does such a little man have to sit behind such a big desk?
I still love the commentary when Milius and Schwarzenegger are talking about the scene where he falls into the cave.
That commentary is legendary.
Oh, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. But when he falls into the cave and the dogs are biting him or whatever, and he's like, John, I'm bleeding. That's great, Arnold. Use it.
No, I'm bleeding. Pain is only temporary, Arnold. The movie's forever.
Yes.
No, I don't think it's the doctor biting him. I'm pretty sure he fell down the hole and bludgeoned himself on a rock.
But John, like, bleeding.
He's got blood pouring out of his hairline, right?
Great movie.
It's like he didn't know how to ride a horse. Arnold got thrown off that horse countless times. But I mean, everything, and it looks great. I mean, that shot when he comes out, when the wolves are all surrounding the cave. I promised Forbes I'd talk about this scene too. When he goes down there and into the tomb of the Atlantean king,
mm-hmm.
and when he finds the sword, I think the sword is called the Atlantean, isn't it?
Yeah.
When he finds his sword, and there's another bit of Polidori's score that's absolutely fantastic. And of course, it ends with this great shot of Conan. The entire scene is great. You know, the whole, like, the skeleton lurching forward as it falls out of the chair. You know, reaching
the hand.
Yeah, and it's just like it's another thing from Conan of, you know, like, nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is, and I knowing like Milius for what he is, I wouldn't doubt for a second if he if you know this was his personal throwback to I am Ozymandias, look upon my works and tremble.
Yeah.
Right, you know, this great former king, and now all he is just a dusty old skeleton covered in rusty armor. Right, he's like reaches forward for the sword and just collapses onto the ground, and it ends with this amazing shot of Conan climbing out, and the wolves are all surrounding him, howling and barking and everything, and he just like triumphantly smashes the chain off his ankle. You know, it's like at that moment, it's slave no more.
Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. And it's just Arnold gives this great, just the look on his face. The camera settles on him when he just turns and stares right at the camera.
Yeah,
it's just great shot.
Great movie.
I think it's safe to say that if it wasn't for James Cameron, we would have probably gotten 5 more Conan films.
Yeah. probably.
Actually, Arnold has said in interviews before The Terminator came out, all he got offered were Viking and sword and sorcery movies. Yeah.
But now, I mean, I read an interview with Arnold recently, just recently, talking about how he's so happy to be going back to Conan again.
Yeah.
He really cannot wait for this new King Conan movie to hit. Like, he's immensely...
Is Milius involved in this at all?
No.
He's producing it.
Oh, is he producing? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Last I'd heard, he was involved, but...
I'm sure he'll be a hands-on producer, not one of those in-name-only things, you know?
Yeah, good chance. Moving on, I guess, we'll...
Yeah, the days when Milius can't make it to set, if he gets too sick, they just gotta put John Goodman in his clothes from Big Lebowski.
Market zero! We'll move on now. We're moving to our bads. You all, again, I'm sure, are familiar with how this concept works. Bad does not necessarily mean bad movie. Bad means, you know, that the movie may be flawed in some way, shape, or form, or not quite a masterpiece. It could be something that we still really love, or vice versa. It could be something that's really considered a masterpiece, but for some reason or another, it just kind of gnaws at our crow or something for, you know, it's just something that, you know, for some reason, it doesn't quite ring true.
The modem appears to be plugged in, but we just can't connect.
Yeah, there you go. It just keeps dropping the Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
I'm gonna flip things around. I'm going to turn the table a little bit here, and I'm going to start with John on this one.
If you're really going to turn the table, you start with yourself.
Nah, I'll start with you.
No. My bad is one of those examples of a movie that I very much enjoy, but has a undeniable cheese factor that just cannot be ignored. And I'm going to go with Milius' 1984 chilling documentary, Red Dawn.
Important documentary.
Yeah. Oh, my. This movie changed this is what ended the Cold War.
and almost his career.
Yeah.
Yeah. Milius was going to bait the Russians into something they couldn't, you know, the Russians saw this movie and got terrified. This and Rambo. They saw this and got terrified and, you know, just spent themselves into oblivion. Red Dawn, you know, what is there not to like? You know, Russian and Cuban paratroopers land. I mean, it starts out with a text crawl, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, talking about how grain shortages or whatever forced them.
The technical goes so fast that if you don't read it, it's like, what the hell?
What is isn't it going off? It's like you're streaking through the clouds while the text crawl's going on.
Which was a holdover shot from Superman the movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, I kept expecting Superman to pull out of the clouds. But no, it's just it's a deadly, deadly serious movie about Russian and Cuban paratroopers invading the United States. But, you know, it's essentially World War III. But you're not seeing any grand scenes of the war. It's all told. It's all the comings and goings of this small town that's been garrisoned by the Cubans and eventually the Russians. And a group of the teenagers from the football team, a small group of teenagers that managed to escape detection and head off into the hills. And, you know, turn the football team and the rallying cry into a guerrilla movement. And it's told over the course of I don't know how many years. Is it years or only a few months?
Only a few months, I think.
But it goes through. But it goes through all the seasons. So it's like a year. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it's a movie that's got a really really good cast, and like Conan, it's infinitely quotable, but for the wrong reasons. Because Red Dawn is, for something that is so serious, is one of the cheesiest movies I've ever seen. You know, they've got like, oh my, that scene with Harry Dean Stanton.
Avenge me!
Boys, avenge me!
But in 1984, that was a pretty chilling scene, though.
It still is a pretty chilling scene. And the, I can't remember, because I remember somebody gets shot in the movie while singing America the Beautiful. Is that him?
It's not him, but I think it's one of the groups he's in.
Yeah.
The firing squad, and somebody starts singing America the Beautiful just before they get shot to pieces. And then Powers Booth comes and saves the whole fucking movie.
Yes.
Because none of the kids in it are very likable. That's one of the problems I have with it. Yeah, you're spending all this time with these teenagers, and none of them are really all that likable. Patrick Swayze's really kind of cold and aloof. Charlie Sheen's really whiny. One of the kids is a psychopath. And then the girls show up for some odd reason. And then Powers Booth comes, and I don't like using the word gravitas very much. I think it's a really, really pretentious word. But he lends gravitas to it. He comes and it's the first time you find out in the movie the scale of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a throwaway line in it about, he says, oh God, what is it, half a billion Chinamen? Mm-hmm. So they're talking about how many who's on the American side in this thing, and he makes the thing about half a million Chinese, and then somebody says, "I thought there were a billion," and he just looks at him. And you get that sensation of, you know, the shit has really hit the fan here.
I enjoyed Red Dawn immensely, and I was leaning on that for my bad as well. So thanks again, John.
Well, now you get to talk. Now you get to talk about it anyway.
You're stealing my thunder on me. You thunder.
And just like Powers Booth saved Red Dawn, now Steve gets to save my bad.
It is Red Dawn is my bad though.
Oh, okay. So we've got three of us picking Red Dawn. My thing with Red Dawn, I don't have the same issues with it that John does in terms of character and that sort of thing. Like I actually enjoyed like Swayze's performance in it. I thought Sheen was fine, you know, like I thought that their reaction to the events that was going on, like to what was happening around them, their reactions actually felt pretty realistic and pretty well thought out. You know, like I thought that Milius put a bit of thought into, you know, okay, a bunch of kids in, you know, this more rugged part of the United States. You're in the Rockies or whatever, you know, you're in Colorado or somewhere, and these guys are, these are the kind of kids who dad took hunting on the weekends. You know, they had their little cabin out in the woods and stuff like that, you know. They're outdoorsy. They're that type. And their reactions to the events, like to the invasion and all this kind of stuff, it always felt like a pretty thoughtful response to me. It always felt like Milius kind of said, you know, like, were I a kid growing up in this era and raised in this fashion, this is how I would have reacted, and this is how my friends would have reacted, this is what we would have done, you know? And for that, it felt kind of realistic to me. And I did like as well that they did spend a bit of time in the movie. Like, it doesn't all occur in a week. You know, you do get the feeling that time passes. You do get the feeling that they all kind of fall into these roles pretty well, and especially where they don't have any, like, adult supervision, they kind of, you know, they gravitate more to just being teenagers with this attitude that what they're doing is okay and that sort of thing. And I always liked at the end of the movie, like, the events that happen at the end, not to spoil anything, it's almost kind of like a wake-up call. You know, when stuff starts to go bad for them, they become children again. They become frightened children again, and you kind of see that in how the actors portray the characters. You know, you see that, like, shit, you know, what we're doing has consequences. We're not all going to come out of this alive. You know, like, that kind of, you get that real response to it, and I thought he did that amazingly well. I thought Milius really nailed that, and I thought that was something that was completely missing in the shitty remake from 2 years ago or whatever it was. You know, like, that movie felt like an action movie with no consequence. It felt like, you know, like they totally missed the point of the original film when they remade it, you know? And
all you have to do is look at the opening parachute scene. That's two entirely different styles going on.
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, big time. But what I don't really like about Red Dawn, I can't blame the movie for, and this is why it's a bad, it hasn't aged well, because those ideals feel so outdated to me. You know, like those whole, the whole Red Scare, the whole, you know, Cubans and Russians paratrooping in the United States, and, you know, this, the
Ronnie Reagan's America.
Yeah, the whole conservative, you know, like, one of the first scenes in the film is, you can have my gun when you pry it from my cold dead hands, the bumper sticker, you know, and it's like, really? Like, isn't that a little bit over the top in terms of how it presents its message, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And,
oh my God, I'm on the Wikipedia page for Red Dawn.
Yeah.
Adam Arsenault was quoted.
Nice.
That's fantastic.
Adam Arsenault of the website DVD Verdict opined that the film often feels like a Republican wet dream manifested into a surrealistic Orwellian nightmare.
There you go. That sums there it up go. Pretty well.
thanks, Adam.
I wish you were here, Adam. We miss you.
And he's Canadian,
he
too.
He is Canadian.
He was with us at the Cronenberg podcast.
He was, yeah. But, you know, it is a film that I really enjoy. But, you know, that whole, like, Russian tanks pulling up to a McDonald's and, like, all of this imagery of, you know, old Russia and old communism and stuff. And it's, you can't fault the movie for it, because this was the era that it was made in. This is the era it was crafted in. But now you look at it, and it just all feels so hokey, you know? And that's why I can't call it.
Well, especially now that, you know, we know the Russians weren't the boogeyman everyone thought they were.
Yeah, you know, they weren't McCarthy.
Right.
McCarthy's
picture
of, like, evil personified and stuff. Communism is not a villainous word, you know, like that sort of thing, right? But it's just, you know, we live in a different world now, and sadly, it's kind of more of a picture of its time and a product of its time, and not in the same way as something like To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, it's not a movie that has aged well, and it's through no fault of Milius or the people involved in the movie. It's just time has kind of passed it by.
I have a quick question for you.
And you know something, Cus? It also gave us the 2003 video game Freedom Fighters, which justifies its existence.
It was freaking awesome. What was the question?
So let me. I was just going to ask you a question. At the time, there was a lot of American miniseries on TV. There was, like, America with a K, and there was another one, I believe, that had to do with, like, the Russians and America, like, being, you know, being taken over. Why do you think Red Dawn was the one that just scared people and also angered people so much, whereas the other, like, miniseries type of thing, they were just kind of – they were on one night and forgotten about? You know, what was it about Red Dawn that
– I think just, it's the having the teenagers, you know,
I think, danger. I think the biggest thing about Red Dawn, and the one thing that I still remember to this day, I remember when the movie opened, the weekend it opened, one of the guys in my class seeing it and describing it to me. That opening sequence, man, the parachuters coming in on the high school, that sequence at the time was terrifying. Because it felt like a reality. Like this, we didn't know what was going on. I mean, us where we are, our little rock in the North Atlantic, it didn't mean shit to us, you know, but the world as a whole, you know, everybody was on the verge of World War III. You know, everybody thought World War III could be right around the corner. And all the talk about nuclear weapons and all of this stuff, and communism is the big red boogeyman, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But I think that sequence, like seeing paratroopers just land in a football field and start mowing down teachers and students and this kind of stuff, you know, like that was kind of terrifying. And none of the other movies really pull that off the same way. Mm-hmm. It's that shocker of an opening.
What I also think it feels like, too, is, and I'm going to get stupidly political here for a second. Nobody likes, you know, no matter how big a person is, everybody feels the same way when they fall, you know, that whole being loss of control type thing.
Yep.
And that opening scene, you know, is, you know, this, what's this town? Calumet, Colorado.
Yeah.
Little small, you know, this little small town is the American dream, right? This is middle America, the American dream personified.
Yeah.
And these paratroopers land and start tearing the shit out of everything, and nobody can do a damn thing about it. Right?
I think I remember seeing, I don't know if it was for the remake or for the original, there was a poster or an ad or something for it, and the big tagline was, if it could happen here, it could happen anywhere, was the thing.
I know Red Dawn's thing was, in our time, no foreign enemy has ever occupied American soil until now.
And one thing Milius does in this film that a lot of filmmakers don't do, and I don't know if you guys notice this or not, but whenever there's an explosion or gunfire, you see the explosion and then you hear it, which is the way it is in real life,
as opposed to,
you know, and I really like that attention to detail.
That's because Milius has fired a lot of guns.
Yeah, blown up a lot of things.
And has probably been around quite a few explosions.
But I think, you know, I think it's an effective flick. I think it works really well. I mean, other than that era, you know, that whole portrayal just, I mean, the idea of it now with the rest of the Eastern Bloc or whatever in the state that it's in, it just seems so absurd now that we could ever have been afraid of these people as a world power, as a colossus, you know? And I guess that's the biggest thing that dates
it. Did Red Dawn come out before or after that little girl sent? No, that must have been after.
What's that?
Yes, it was definitely after. No, because she sent that letter to Khrushchev. No, that little girl that sent the letter to Khrushchev. I think it was after the Cuban Missile Crisis and asking why he wanted to start war. Why he wanted to go to war, and he actually wrote her back.
Yeah.
And it's just. Yeah, like that whole Russian boogeyman thing. Now that you know the Halloween mask is gone.
Yeah. They're like, you know, the Nazis in an Indiana Jones movie now. You know, it's kind of like,
yeah.
And I mean, yes, they're trivialized and they're marginalized now. And I mean, not to the same degree that the Nazis are. I mean, the Nazis are like the Hollywood boogeyman now, you know, and it's just they've become almost like a running gag, kind of like Islam was with True Lies, you know.
I
mean, everybody kind of looks at Russian villains and stuff the same way now, and I think that's a lot of what really pulls the fangs from Red Dawn, you know?
But then Powers Booth is there to try to put some of those fangs back.
Yeah. And
Or Powers Booth is there to be Bela Lugosi fighting with that octopus.
So, I mean, that's it, Red Dawn, myself and John. Cameron, did you want to add anything else on Red Dawn?
I do. I think it's really – I want to talk about real quick the casting of this film. I think obviously Milius took a page out of Coppola when he was making The Outsiders, because this cast is a who's who of names here. Obviously, it's Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey before they made Dirty Dancing.
Yep.
I also am just like – it amazes me that you know, that like some people really like this film and some people really hate this film, but – it amazes me how just because Milius has a different political view than a lot of other people in the world, that people like tried to shun the film and destroy his career. To me, I feel like, hey, if he feels differently or thinks differently than me, that's awesome because I want to see that person's point of view on things. Instead, he got pretty much silenced after this film.
And what really pisses me off about that, what pisses me off to no end, is the double standard that's in play. Milius writes a film from a conservative point of view and gets blacklisted for it, and I won't go into the details, but we all know what Polanski did, and yet he's heralded as this, you know, oppressed figure in classic Hollywood and whatnot, you know? And it's like, get over it, guys. Like, really? Like, you're going to blacklist a guy because he doesn't adhere to your ideals, and then you're going to defend a convicted you-know-what. You know, like, to me, that's just it's just such a double standard and such heavy bullshit, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I was insulted that they even remade the film because of that. You know what I mean? Because, like, some no-name person's going to remake this film and, you know, go on with their lives. And, you know, John Milius has had to, you know, basically do uncredited rewrites for the last 20, 30 years because of this movie. And when you watch this movie, you go, okay, I either like it or don't like it. But at the same time, it's like, why would this film destroy somebody's career? I've seen a lot worse films than, you know, that does. I mean, you know, the two guys that wrote the latest Spider-Man movie, why did they have a career? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm watching them. Yeah, and it's, to me, it just serves more as a testament to how accomplished a filmmaker John Milius is. And this is a guy who has crafted gold out of a film, out of a catalog of what, 13 movies I think he's directed.
Yep,
including his TV work. And I mean, you know, for a man to take Conan the Barbarian, you know, to take a at that point 60-year-old pulp novel and a 10 or 15-year-old silly Marvel comic book, and you know, to make a beautiful art film out of it, and for him to make a concept as batshit insane as Red Dawn and turn it into a completely competent and at times chilling action movie, right?
Effective.
You figure studio,
you know?
Yeah, studio. Studios would be lying. Why couldn't he at least be, you know, this a hired gun or a journeyman filmmaker? I mean, this is John Milius is a guy who, when action movies were getting stupid in the mid to late 90s, this is a guy who could have, you know, turned them back into lean, mean machines again.
Yep.
The funny thing to me is, like, Don Siegel made as much conservative pictures, and he never had any problems.
No, exactly. Even guys like Ford and Peckinpah and these guys, I mean, these guys were hardcore. They were hardliners, you know? fuck communism and all of that nonsense, you know? And they all had careers. Peckinpah derailed himself, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And a couple quick things. One is that, you know, a lot of people now make fun of this movie. It's like, oh, isn't that the movie where the high schoolers take down the Russians? And, you know, but it's like, you know, if you really think about it, like you were talking about how Milius, you know, intelligently thought about, you know, what may happen with a scenario like this. I think it's totally feasible to think, because, you know, 18, 19-year-old kids are who we send to wars anyway, right? I mean, I can see them living in the mountains with a couple of shotguns. And, I mean, the moment after that, you know, that amazing montage, you know, where that ends with Wolverine.
Yep.
And when you see, like, C. Thomas Howe all, like, guerrilla-styled out up on the roof just throwing grenades, and Leah Thompson with that machine gun in the little storage shed. I mean, it's just like, holy crap. I mean, yeah, there is some cheesiness to it. But to me, it's like, I don't know. There is a very scary reality in that segment too, especially with, like, when you see that, like, old man. There's that close up of that old man right before they're about to shoot him, and he just spits right at the camera, and you know that's what Milius would do in that situation.
And you know he's dead. you know this guy's going down, right?
Yeah. So I mean, I think it is. I agree with you that, you know, it doesn't stand up today quite so much as back then. The reason why I put it on as my bad is because I think the movie starts really strong and really good, and there's a forward momentum. And while I don't disagree with you at all about Powers Booth being in the film because he makes everything better, I do think that about two-thirds through the movie slows down to the point that, like, for about 20-25 minutes, you almost kind of don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. And then I think the last, like, 10 minutes bring it back. But that middle half hour, I think, slows down. It's almost like a go get popcorn, go to the bathroom, come back.
Yeah. It does spin its wheels. You get a little bit of a montage of just people popping out of holes and firing machine guns for a half hour, you know. That middle act definitely could have used some tightening.
Well, once they go to the snow, it's like a whole different movie.
Yeah. It's true.
I'm just really bummed out because I remember reading an interview or hearing an interview with Milius saying, I should have directed 20 more movies, but Red Dawn killed my career. And it's just like, I've seen so many terrible movies and people go on to have great careers, but, you know, I don't understand. It's like, just because Hollywood didn't agree with what Milius did, that therefore, you know, even Peter Bart, I think, was like one of the producers of the film, and he was like aghast that what Milius had transformed Kevin Reynolds' script into. And it's like, you know, I don't know. To me, I feel like
Hollywood doesn't forget that kind of thing easily. Just remember that they booed Elia Kazan when he received his honorary Oscar.
Yeah, yeah.
And that man's made some amazing movies, but, you know.
He was a narc, so.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, I may not agree with, you know, things that Milius stands for sometimes, but I think that he should have every right to say them in a movie, and I think it's fascinating because I hate seeing the same homogenized vision from filmmaker after filmmaker, and I want to see different points of views.
For sure. And, I mean, I think there it goes to prove, like, when you look at the remake and how absolutely, utterly terrible it was, you know.
Well, and how scared shitless they were because they made it Chinese, and then they realized, oh, my God, there goes our box office in China. So they had to
there
make
goes
it North
our third largest market in the world, you know, so we've got to make apologies to them. And it just, to me, it's just, man, like.
Who do we go? It's got to be a communist country. We named the movie Red Dawn.
But it,
is Cuba still mad at us?
But it's just so pointless. Like, the remake is just such a pointless movie. You know,
they shouldn't have made it like the South Park movie. They made it Canada.
The only good thing they did with the remake,
Maple Dawn.
The only positive I can take from the remake is I like what they did with Thor's character in it. He plays the Swayze role. What's his name? Chris
Thor
Hemsworth.
Hemsworth, Thor? Yeah, Thor. You know, Chris Hemsworth.
No. From now on, whenever we mention him in this podcast, his name is Thor Odinson.
Lord of Thunder and Jesus. But no.
When the God of Thunder comes back from the Iraq War.
Yeah, but no, I liked what they did with his character. It kind of made sense, you know, like the whole, he was over in Afghanistan or wherever, you know, and came back, so he had that military background, more so than, you know, what was his name, Jed? Swayze's character, you know,
he's Jed in both.
Is he Jed in both? Okay, but Swayze's character, you know, he was the older, rugged son who went hunting every weekend. He wasn't, you know, Gulf War veteran, right? But right. I thought it, like, that made sense. But at the same time, the whole movie just felt like a soulless exercise. You know, it was just action scene after action scene, and that's what happens when you get the story without someone with the vision like Milius had. You know, like, Milius had a much stronger vision going in. And I think that, I mean, it goes to show just how effective a filmmaker he could be, even if the subject matter now is kind of cheesy, you know? Gabe, what did you have for a bad?
I chose another not very well-known movie called The Wind and the Lion.
Oh. Because Sean Connery is a shitty Berber?
Yes, but that's part of it. I mean, this movie had a lot of goodwill from me going in, just starting with the credits and the Jerry Goldsmith score, which is fantastic.
Amazing score.
And those really old school credits that you're in for a good adventure movie. And the basic story is pretty good. It's about this American woman who gets kidnapped by a Berber. Because I don't even remember why he kidnaps her.
Oh, he sees a man.
Because he's got the in his name. What other reason does he need?
Well, if you saw Murphy Brown in her 20s, you'd kidnap her too, okay?
Yeah. And I mean, it begins very strongly, and there's really some interesting stuff in there, but it just gets bogged down in multiple scenes of them, like, kind of having banter and Like, I don't know how many times Connery says, I am only but a servant of Allah. And then Candace Bergen...
I'm only but a servant of Allah.
And then Candace Bergen says something annoying. Like, it's just that kind of dynamic keeps on going for most of the movies, and there's no real hook for me, you know, in this, as a story, you know, to get you involved in the movie, besides it being looking good and having some good action scenes, and all those scenes with Teddy Roosevelt are amazing.
Does Hammer have some great action scenes, though?
Yes, it does have, like, that's why I chose it as a bad, over like a good or even an ugly, is the really good action scenes. It's filmed really well, and as long as Sean Connery doesn't open his mouth, he does look kind of Arabic, and he does have that presence. But as soon as he starts talking, it's over.
He's about as Arabic as he is Egyptian.
once that brogue starts rolling, you can't talk that back in.
But I found the. This is something that I found about Red Dawn 2 and a couple of other Milius movies, and I brought it up earlier. It's like he has a great ear for dialogue, but I feel like besides Conan and Farewell to the King, he doesn't have a great sense of storytelling.
I could see that. I could see where you get that from. I think he likes to... It's not so much that he doesn't have a sense of storytelling, but I think he likes to live in the moment a lot. I think, like, when he's more so in editing, like when he's in with an editor and he's sitting down, I think he likes to linger on moments a lot. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. Like, I can understand how you could find it meandering or whatever, but I kind of like that in movies. I kind of like when it sits still for a little while and lets you kind of...
Like, in Conan, you know, having those episodic moments really makes it part of the story, because it works in that movie, I feel.
Yeah, I think it helps the movies become transitory, you know, it kind of helps take you to another place, and that's what I liked about, I liked that feeling in The Wind and the Lion, the same with The Man Who Would Be King, or Farewell to the King, you know, like, it invests me more, it gets me more into... When I'm seeing these simple moments, when it's not just going from action scene to action scene to action scene, I get a little more invested. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, to me, what I mean is more like, there's no, like, in Wind of the Lion particularly, there's no forward momentum. Like, he never makes you part of the drama, you know? It's not that interesting, all those little political details. You stay for, like, the look of the movie. And for those scenes back in the USA with, you know, Teddy Roosevelt tearing everybody a new one.
I know what you mean. It's kind of like, you know, you watch Lawrence of Arabia for the character interactions and the politics and stuff like that. And you watch The Wind and the Lion to see, you know, Berbers fighting Americans and whatnot. You know, like,
yes, because he can't really make it work for some reason, the politics. I mean, in another movie, it can work. But in that movie, it's just set dressing.
That movie would have to not have Murphy Brown and Sean Connery.
Yes.
The original cast was going to be Omar Sharif and Faye Dunaway.
And see, that would have been fucking phenomenal.
Yes.
Absolutely phenomenal.
And
I'm just picturing Omar Sharif delivering that line at the end in the letter.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like the lion, must stay in my place.
Yeah. I'm going to say it's not an episode of They Came from the North if Steve doesn't say something absolutely blasphemous.
Okay.
How the fuck did Sean Connery ever get respected as a good actor, man? It's the Christopher Lee rule. You hang around long enough and people start to love you. You know?
Didn't you address this last week with your Zardoz?
He probably did. Connery is a fucking
He does this every time Sean Connery comes up. That's why we're never doing Brian De Palma. We're never doing Steven Spielberg.
We are doing Spielberg, goddammit. Spielberg will come.
And the
if a James Bond director could direct more than one movie that wasn't James Bond, we wouldn't cover them. Now we're presenting the good, the bad, and the ugly of director Guy Hamilton.
But, But yeah, I mean, it's a movie with a good old school feel to it. But in the end, it didn't quite work for me.
It felt kind of empty.
Yes.
I could definitely see that. Is that everybody for Bads? Did we miss anyone?
No, that's it. You guys all went
for Red Dawn. Three of us went for Red Dawn, yeah. That's all of us.
Wow.
Real quick, I just want to add to Winning the Lion. It says online here that Milius had propositioned Orson Welles to place Charles Foster Kane in Wind of the Lion, but the studio wouldn't let him because they were afraid RKO would sue them.
Wow.
Instead, he used the character of Hearst. That's interesting. That would have changed everything in cinema history.
I love little things like that. Backdoor shenanigans.
Hey, I keep forgetting John Huston is in it.
He is, yep.
Yes.
And Jeffrey Lewis, who I love and doesn't do enough.
If Omar Sharif and Faye Dunaway had been cast in this film, this movie would have been on Blu-ray about 5 years ago.
Yeah, yep, I agree. It would have been considerably more held in much higher regard, I think. And yeah. It kind of sucks. One thing, this is a total side road and totally derailing our conversation, but I have to muse. I'm kind of a little disheartened by, you know, when DVD came along, we were coming out of, like, the end of the Blockbuster era and all, and by Blockbuster, I mean Blockbuster Video and VHS and rental pricing and yada, 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 yada. And DVD kind of came along, and all of a sudden, you know, libraries became the thing. Everybody having their own home video library. All of us movie guys started getting, you name it. I mean, people were scrambling to get it out there on DVD to kind of fill the void. And it kind of sucks that Blu-ray has kind of, because of the whole digital age and streaming and all of this kind of stuff, Blu-ray has never reached that same proliferation that you saw with DVD at its height. And you don't get the same treatment, you know? You don't get the same... You remember being excited when a movie was coming out on DVD, and then, like, you know, I remember Big Trouble in Little China, for example, getting, like, this big, lavish special edition and going, like, wait, what? You know? Fantastic. And you don't see stuff like that at all with Blu-ray. You don't see...
Whatever decision maker at Fox Video. Remember that special edition we did for Cleopatra and Patton? Now we're doing the same thing for Big Trouble in Little China and Die Hard. It's not the 80s anymore, sir. How are you going to explain this?
I remember somebody came up to me a few years ago when Blu-ray was starting, and they asked me, why should I upgrade to Blu-ray? I said, well, there's one name, and that's Pixar.
Yeah, yeah. Although that said, I mean, a lot of the classic stuff, I mean, we thought DVD was the shiznit back in 98, 99, 2000, but some of the stuff on Blu-ray, man, like seeing stuff like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or Outlaw Josie Wales, Lawrence of Arabia, some of these movies, they look absolutely stunning on Blu-ray, you know, and the DVDs, you go back to the DVD and you realize how dated and aged that they looked, and then you see them now and you're just like, oh my God. It is a drastic difference. It is a night and day difference, and it sucks that we're not going to see, you know, that lavish treatment given to stuff like The Wind and the Lion or Farewell to the King. You know, like a lot of these movies are going to languish in obscurity now, and even like stuff like Salvador and The Year of Living Dangerously and like other movies we've talked about in the past. You know, that are really, really, you know, awesome movies that just never really quite punched through to the mainstream consciousness. And in the day,
I'm still shocked that we got Sorcerer on Blu-ray.
Yeah, yes. That's unbelievable. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Is, you know, okay, we got Sorcerer. That's awesome, you know.
But with no extras.
No. There you go, right? Hey, at least...
Yeah, because...
You guys remember those old... when Warner Brothers was coming out of the whole flipper case thing, when they started doing their special editions, and they all came in those two-disc, like, booklet style?
Oh, digital cases, yeah.
Yeah. I miss those.
They were nice. They were really nice. They've been doing something similar with Blu-ray. They've been doing the digibooks like that.
Yeah.
And I've got a few of those there.
Like, I'm still shocked to this day that they never did one of those two disc things for the first Lethal Weapon.
Yeah. But they've got a few, and they've done some pretty nice work with them. Like the Deliverance set is really nice. Outlaw Josie.
Outlaw Josie.
There's some good ones. Farewell to the King, or The Man Who Would Be King. Sorry, of all the movies, I never thought I would see a lavish, you know, Blu-ray special edition of, and that's a great movie. You know,
you talk about going back and watching DVD and seeing the difference in quality. Have you gone back and watched VHS?
Yes.
Oh,
the moment
because it's the only way we can get split second.
Yep.
Thankfully, somebody found a way to give us Like Home in Peace on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But it's the VHS is still the only way to get split second.
There was a DVD print back in the early days, but it goes for like $150-$200 now, apparently.
Well, stop buying records, motherfucker, and buy it.
I'm a, you know, like I'm sure you guys, I, you know, I was a VHS kid. I collected everything or taped everything. And now I go back and if I have something on tape that's not on DVD, I put it in. And I can't believe the sound. I hear that humming. I hear the machine.
Yep.
I have to rewind it. It's like, what the hell?
Yeah, see, I'm like one of those guys who can't sleep without a fish tank in this room. I can't watch movies without that humming.
Well, I got the projector now, so I get my little bit of humming there, so. So that all works out.
Movies are always better with a little hummers, right?
On that note, moving on to what is many people's favorite part of our show, the ugly. This is, generally speaking, where we unload our excess baggage and generally rail, rant, rave, roar, whatever, movies that we typically despise, whether well liked by other people or considered good or not, we consider them to be utter total shit.
I've been eating wasabi to get mad.
I think this week's probably going to prove a little interesting, because I really, you know, in all honesty, looking over Milius's body of work, I don't really see anything there that I can quantify out and out as a total pure ugly. I am going to go first.
Are we all going McVeigh?
No, we're not. No, don't break the rules.
17 minutes.
I couldn't find an ugly this week, guys. So everyone's a winner.
Let's talk about another good for 18 minutes. I'm gonna go first because mine is gonna be very, very brief. I'm not gonna ramble. I have nothing more to add other than I'm going with Big Wednesday because I generally
yes.
like surfing. Done.
Well, I think I'll go next, because I also chose Big Wednesday, because it's pretentious bullshit about surfing.
And you don't like surfing?
Well, pretentious bullshit about surfing? It's
Gabe
motherfucking surfing.
Gabe, don't surf.
Who needs, like, big, like, speeches and, like, lofty narration and, like, this is a sport for men. When it's surfing, I mean, there's some good things.
Excuse me, surfing gave a Subotai a thief and archer, so you'd be goddamn grateful.
Was
he in that movie?
Yes.
Fantastic. Did he have a giant Fu Manchu mustache?
No. My favorite thing, though, about Big Wednesday is poor George Lucas, because Spielberg, Lucas, and Milius all decided to trade points for their movies, and so Milius got Star Wars, Spielberg, Lucas got
Close Encounters,
yeah, Spielberg got, I don't know, I can't remember. But Lucas ended up getting Big Wednesday's points and lost everything.
I mean, it's not a completely terrible movie. It's kind of interesting in that hanging around. It reminded me kind of Kevin Reynolds' Fandango.
Yeah.
But worse. Just not that good, because Fandango's pretty good. It's just a lot of hanging around, doing nothing, going to Vietnam War, having a mentor with a big beard who's called Bear.
Gabriel, I just don't think you like William Catt as an actor.
No, I mean, the only good thing about this was Gary Busey, to be honest. what's his character name? Bill the Masochist? Something like that. At one point he's getting, like, barbecue sauce on him to be thrown into the oven.
Big Wednesday is one of the movies on Gary Busey's Amazon clicker when you watch that commercial.
But yeah, I don't have much more to say about it. It's just kind of there and not that interesting.
I admire the film, but I totally understand what you're talking about. But there is a part of me that just says, hey, this kind of movie would never be made today. So that, to me, I kind of excuse it that way.
All right, who's next?
John, you got something for us?
Yes. Yes, I do. So, in the spring of 1990, Paramount had an unexpected mega smash in the form of The Hunt for Red October, which, if you'll remember, I went cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over in our John McTiernan episode.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. I think that was my good, actually.
It's a great movie.
I can't believe I picked that over Die Hard. I guess because so other people picked Die Hard, and I just wanted to make sure that Hunt for Red October got sweaty man love. This, of course, meant that there'd be a volley of similar military/techno-thrillers based on best-selling novels from that same period. One of which was John, You Can Have My Gun When I Shove It Up Your Pink Okami-Ass Milius's Flight of the Intruder, based on the 1986 New York Times best-selling novel by Stephen Kuntz. Now, it's a perfectly serviceable thriller and a damn entertaining movie in its own right. But my spider sense keeps tingling whenever I watch it, which I've done a lot. I like this movie. But it screams Hired Gun to me. And I'd go so far as to say it's the only movie in Milius' entire catalog that does that. Yeah, it's just the only movie that he doesn't feel personal about. And I, after what Cameron brought up of what happened to him after Red Dawn, that doesn't surprise me at all. It is a fun flick, especially if you miss that cool little era when our action movies were starting to grow up before they became obnoxious teenagers in the late 90s. But don't think for one second that it's going to be anything more than a cold beer and a burger.
I dug it, actually. I really like Flight of the Intruder. Now, mind you, I had read the book before I saw the movie. I was a little army geek. I mean, you know, I read G.I. Joe comics and Punisher comics and military novels nonstop. I think I might have been in grade 5 or 6 when I read the book.
Dude, I read all three of them before I saw this movie.
Yeah, but I really enjoyed it, and a lot of why I enjoyed it was Willem Dafoe, man. He was fan-fucking-tastic in that movie.
As Tiger.
Yeah. I'm in the Great pipes. Best. I'm in the, what was it? I'm in the whatever, 5x5 or whatever, when he's down at the crashed intruder with the handgun shooting at all the guys in the woods. And, yeah. You know, oh man, that scene's absolutely fucking amazing. Great scene. You know, it's almost as good as Elias's exit from Platoon. You know?
Only this time John Milius lets Elias win.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I guess.
Well, no, he still goes out, but instead of getting shot in the back, he gets shot in the back and then explodes.
What do you think of Danny Glover in this movie?
I like Danny Glover in the movie, but Danny Glover, I mean, he's kind of serviceable no matter where he is. You know, he's Danny Glover.
Except in Shooter.
Oh, Shooter, he was terrible.
I have to be honest, I couldn't watch more than 5 minutes of this movie.
Really?
Well, the beginning scene reminded me of playing, like, Wing Commander on Windows 95. I couldn't get into it because it looked terrible, the effects, you know?
Yeah, I don't think it had a huge budget, and I think it was one of those movies, too, that I don't know if it's that it came together in a hurry or that it was like they had some trouble getting it made, one or the other.
No, I honestly think it came together in a hurry. I think it's just strike while the iron is hot, you know,
yeah.
Paramount were riding. They had a pretty successful summer that year. They had, actually, no, they didn't have too successful a summer. No, sorry, because they had Hunt for Red October, but then Days of Thunder wasn't what they thought it was going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, you know, Hunt for Red October was huge, and they snapped up the rights to Flight of the Intruder, which was a gigantic book, right?
Yeah.
Massive smash hit of a novel, and just pulled the movie together, and, you know, Milius still probably had some name recognition.
Well, he had done writing on Hunt for Red October, didn't he? He was involved with Hunt for Red October, wasn't he?
And, I mean,
he did rewrites for all the Clancy movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is probably why Hunt for Red October is so good, or one of many reasons.
I was actually one of the very pleasantly surprised by how good Some of All Fears was.
Believe it or not, in the documentary on Milius, they have a moment where Sean Connery where this guy talks about how Sean Connery was going to turn down Hunt for October, and Milius was down the hall from the producer's office, and so he said, "Hey, John, you want to rewrite Connery's dialogue?" And then he said, "Connery, if John rewrites your dialogue, will you do the movie?" He says, "Yes." Milius did it. Connery's in the movie.
And it was
nice.
It was a great movie. It really was. Yeah. I mean, but now, like I said, I really enjoyed Flight of the Intruder as well. In fact, I might go watch it right now.
Oh, yeah, I did too. But I mean, it's just, I've done this a few times with My Ugly. When the reason I choose for My Ugly is that it just, it doesn't feel like the rest of their body of work.
Yeah, yeah.
And not for the right reasons. It's not like, you know, I'm not going to knock Steven Spielberg for experimenting, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But this, to me, just, it felt like a paycheck, right?
Fair enough.
Or actually, not even a paycheck. Knowing what we now know about Milius, it felt like somebody was let back in the clubhouse to play for a little bit, but was told if he got loud, he had to go home again.
Yeah, yeah. And I could definitely see that. I could definitely see that.
Yeah. But, I mean, now, bringing up, this is a theme for all three of my Milius picks. The fact that he turned out what he did with Flight of the Intruder, again, goes to show just how good he is.
Yeah. What about you, Cameron? What have you got for an ugly?
Real quick, I just want to say I agree with you, John, but, you know, I'm somebody who prefers Iron Eagle to Top Gun, so what do I know?
Get out.
Oh, God.
At least Top Gun is brave enough to tell Mom and Dad that it's gay.
I think I hate Louis Gossett Jr. even more than I hate Sean Connery.
I have not seen Iron Eagle for years.
Chocolate Thunder. Sexual chocolate.
I haven't seen that movie in years. I just remember when it came out thinking, oh, I like this better than Top Gun.
I just remember being like, what, an 8 or 9 year old kid watching it, and the scene where he's in the F-16 and he's on the firing range and he misses all the targets and then he turns on his heavy metal music and then proceeds to like blow the shit out of everything. That's all I remember. It's not even that.
It's like you're sitting there going, man, if Top Gun had a theme song by Queen, it'd be so badass.
and Top Gun didn't have Larry B. Scott in it, so
no, I guess not. I guess not.
Yeah. Oh. Anyway,
You've done it for Sean Connery, Steve. How did David Suchet get respected?
I guess he was a Royal Shakespeare actor. I guess that's what did it.
There's no excuse. And if we ever do the director masterminds, I'll tear Patrick Stewart a new one, too.
Anyway, moving on.
All right, for my ugly, I'm actually going to do another made-for-TV movie that Milius did. This was a film that he had, I believe, 10 days to shoot it, and he considers it one of his favorites, primarily because he had full control over it. But in my opinion, while there's still some interesting things in it, I feel just sad for it because this is the work of a filmmaker that, you know, has now been relegated to Showtime in the early 90s, which wasn't credible at all like it is maybe today and when it comes to cable. And it was a film he made called Motorcycle Gang. Oh. And it was part of the Rebel Highway series, which if that reminds people of anything, it's because of Robert Rodriguez's film Road Racers. That was part of the same
kind of thing.
Anyway, but this one stars, believe it or not, Jake Busey and Carla Gugino, and yet manages to be boring as all hell for 82 minutes. And there's some really interesting things about it. I can see why Milius considers it one of his finest films because, like Big Wednesday, it kind of harks back to that, you know, 60s California beach vibe. The problem is that he didn't write this film, so that's step number one, or problem number one. But the acting is, I mean, maybe John will be okay with this, but for me, having the main actor be Gerald McRaney from Major Dad, from the TV show.
No, sorry. Wait, Steve, what if he said having Gerald McRaney from Simon and Simon?
I'm having a conflict. Internal conflict.
And he wasn't the dapper Simon Brother.
No, he wasn't.
He was the Simon Brother you tuned in to see.
Yeah. I just can't. Move on. Keep going.
So anyway, the storyline for the film is that this dad and his family are driving, you know, through California, and they just get terrorized by a motorcycle gang along the highway. That right there makes it sound so much more interesting than the way it is, because a lot of it is just people just sitting on the side of the road and just, you know, having barbecues and bonfires, and then all of a sudden there's like a rape scene, and then it goes on, and it just meanders. Again, a very episodic tone to it, but for 82 minutes, it should not feel like a four-hour film. And in that cheap Showtime early 90s way, you know, I don't
film that kind of VHS.
Yes, exactly. Bad lighting. You know, and this is a guy who just a couple of years earlier had made Fly the Intruder and Farewell to the King, and now he's doing this because this is all the work he could get. You know, and just real fast, the thing that just bums me out is after seeing that documentary, Emilius, is after motorcycle gang, and you know, he had a friend that was in that was like his investment, you know, he dealt with his investments, and he stole most of Emilius's money, so he didn't have much money, so he was taking whatever writing gig he could get, and he went in to be just a staff writer for Deadwood, and the creator of Deadwood, David Milch, said, I'm not going to have the writer of Apocalypse Now be a staff writer on Deadwood. And so Milius, he got Milius a meeting, and Milius pitched Rome, and that's how Rome got started. But I'm glad that Milius got kind of back on track, even though his name is not – people don't even know who the hell he is anymore. But a film like Motorcycle Gang is not a film you would show people to be like, this is John Milius. You know?
No.
But it's not, you know, I would say seek it out and see it if you are a completionist. But if you're not, then I think you should watch the other films we've talked about on this program, not this one.
I agree. Yeah.
Yes.
Except for Big Wednesday. You can skip that one, too.
Well, yeah, there we go.
Just watch Conan twice.
or just turn on the commentary to Big Wednesday and watch it that way.
There we go. Parting thoughts on Milius. Cameron, we'll start with you.
I think he's a really interesting filmmaker. Even though I'd seen some of his films, I didn't even know who he was until I had seen that Hearts of Darkness documentary. And, you know, this is back when I was 14 years old, and just the way the guy talks, I love people like him and Coppola who talk so big and bombastic because it just makes everything they write or make seem so epic. And so, you know, I sought out his films, and I just think it's an utter tragedy, as we've talked about before, that he's not as well known as all the other people that he was filmmakers with in the 70s, when in the 70s he was the screenwriter that made the most money out of all the screenwriters in Hollywood for a good decade, and now he can, you know, barely get any work.
Which is just not fair.
Yeah, and all because of a movie he made in 1984, you know, a movie that, by the way, has been re-released how many times on VHS and DVD, you know? And so obviously it's making the studio money, so they have no problem making money on the film, but, you know, let's bury John Milius and his career with it. I find it really sad because I think that if he had been given the chances that, you know, honestly, I mean – I would have taken away Steven Spielberg's ability to create films after he made Hook, but, you know, that's me. But, you know, I think that Milius should
have... Yeah, then you wouldn't get Minority Report, so just think what Milius might have done if we hadn't taken it away from him.
Exactly.
The thing, though. Right? I could never see Milius doing a science fiction film. I could never see it.
Okay, I'm just saying Minority Report because I love Minority Report. Okay, sorry, I should have said Private Ryan.
There you go, in my opinion, is Spielberg's best movie, so, you know.
Can you imagine if Milius had directed Thor, The Dark World?
Oh, my God.
Anyway, I think that he's a very talented filmmaker. I think he deserves to be rediscovered. And and even a film that he writes that he didn't necessarily direct, I think is worth seeking out just to hear the words. You mentioned poetry when it comes to Conan the Barbarian. Oh, God. I think that, you guys have talked about so many great filmmakers over all your episodes, and I think Milius is one of those ones that it's wrong that he is unknown, and I think that he deserves to be sought out.
Yeah, well, man, you were talking, him even as a screenwriter. Just listen to these lines. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Charlie, don't surf. Terminate with extreme prejudice. Go ahead, make my day. Do you feel lucky, punk? All from John Milius.
Yeah.
Right? And the man designed the octagon for the UFC.
Yeah, he did.
The fact that these guys are put in a cage is because of John Milius. All right, this is just the picture I'm looking at him right now. He's holding what looks to be a shotgun and a cigar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, this is just Milius was a larger-than-life alpha male filmmaker and, was responsible for some pretty goddamn good movies.
Yep.
And I don't even want to get into the politics of why he stopped. It's just, it's sad to me that this guy hasn't made anything since 1997 and hasn't made anything released theatrically since 1991. And, he's probably up to the age now and the way his health is now. I don't think he ever will direct again.
No. He passed on the Genghis Khan project and Conan because of his health. Those two films would have brought him back glory.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, Gabe? Thoughts on...
Well, I think, his main... an asset that often gets unmentioned, I find, is definitely his visual acumen. His movies look beautiful. He knows how to compose shots and give a peculiar atmosphere in the way he shoots his movies. And there's a definite, visual style that you can recognize in most of his movies. And some great moments of just the visual. I'm thinking of Conan practicing with his with the sword, just moving around, or Nolte crawling around in Fellowship, Farewell to the King. I almost said Fellowship of the King. So, but yeah, definitely, I think besides his words, his visual storytelling is also a big plus for him. His minus for me, as I said before, sometimes I feel he gets too focused in these little details and in the characters, and he forgets to tell an actual story. But besides that, he is a very distinctive filmmaker.
I agree with the technical side more so. I mean, I always gravitate to a strong visualist, but, I think as a visual filmmaker, I think Milius is amazing. I think he's an absolutely fantastic, really textured visualist. I think even simple stuff, even stuff like Red Dawn, which is about like a straightforward action movie, really, in terms of how it's presented. But he does such a fantastic job with those action sequences. Like he makes it feel really, really unique, I guess is the word I'd use. It doesn't feel like every other action movie that came out of that time. It feels like its own beast. And then, of course, Conan, which is just, that movie is executed with a painterly grace. It is a thing to behold in terms of visuals. And it never really got a lot of justice done to it in terms of, like, VHS and DVD presentations. You never really saw a really, really cracking-looking version of Conan until Blu-ray. And that movie, man, is just – it's such a beautiful-looking picture. And
I love how you're describing as painterly, and when I watch Conan the Barbarian, I feel like I have a steak in my mouth.
No, but
not like chewing it politely out, like a dog with a steak.
Well, it's painterly in the way that it makes those frazzled pictures come to life.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And I mean, even like, and Farewell to the King is another one. I mean, that is a gorgeous looking movie.
Yes,
and The Wind and the Lion is another one, just amazingly strong visuals, and it doesn't feel like everybody else out there. You know, it doesn't feel like a Malick or someone like that. The closest comparisons would be guys like Sam Peckinpah, you know, and
John Borman.
And John Borman, yeah, yeah. And it does have this slightly, like, in spite of the visuals being so detailed and so textured, there's also a roughness to his films. There's almost like a roughness to the edit and to how the sound is mixed and stuff like that that makes them feel a little more real at the same time. You know, like, they don't have this surreal quality that you see in some, like, really strong, other strong visualists, like guys like Ridley Scott or, you know, Stanley Kubrick, who really like to do these surreal moments and these long kind of slow pans. And, you know, they really like to, they immerse you in their visuals. And what's different about Milius is he does do really strong visuals, but he's not trying to immerse you. He's trying to make you feel like it's a lived-in space. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not presenting it to you. He's trying to bring you there. He's trying to transport you there. You know, and I think he's amazing at doing that.
The town in Red Dawn, you know, feels like a real place, and obviously they shot in a real town.
It feels
lived in, and the fact that the previous film he had made was Conan the Barbarian, again, sword and sorcery, but the world, like you talked about, the textures, it feels lived in. And for somebody who can create two different realities, a small town and a big, epic sword and sorcery epic, and yet make each one feel as authentic and real, I think is a, you know, quality filmmaker.
Hell yeah, big time. And I like you guys say, you know, I think it's tragic that, you know, we didn't get another, you know, we should have been getting Milius movies well into the 21st century. You know, we should, like, until 2006 or 2007, there should have been a steady stream of John Milius movies.
It surprises me that his friends never, you know, came to his rescue or something with financing.
It was a different world, I think, you know, like the Kickstarter thing and all of that hadn't really, the crowdfunding and stuff hadn't really existed, you know? Yeah, I think there is definitely, you know, a Milius cult out there, and I think that, you know, if now were 15 years ago, I think Milius would have definitely had a resurgence. He would have had another career. But then again, you know, look at, like, say, John Carpenter. Mm-hmm. He's got his following, and he hasn't done jack shit. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
But the thing that surprised me the more, like I was saying, is that, you know, like Lucas or Coppola or those guys never came to finance a new production, you know, kind of bail him out.
He always said, though, I remember a choice quote from Milius that said, you know, in that group of people, in that Zoetrope clan, he always felt like an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they were his buddies and they all loved him and all that, but he was like crazy Uncle John, you know?
Well, I read he was like the character of the drag racer in American Graffiti is based on him.
Who's that, Bob Falfa?
Yeah, I think so. I don't remember.
Harrison Ford's character?
Maybe.
and let's not forget that John Carpenter actually quit Hollywood, whereas John Milius was pretty much banned. So
yeah, that's true, too. There's a difference there, too.
Oh, my God. I hope the... when I get this baby rolling, you're going to be hanging on for mercy. I hope Milius works that into everyday conversation.
I guess one last thing we'll leave. Great piece of trivia that most people are probably aware of, but just in case they're not, Milius is one of his contributions to Hollywood pop culture. Walter Sobchak in The Big Lebowski, entirely inspired by John Milius, or by the Zen anarchist, whatever, Zen fascist persona that Milius portrayed for himself in the 70s and 80s was the big inspiration for Walter. And, I mean, if nothing else, Walter's just such a lovable bastard.
There's a funny story about that. In the documentary, Milius says that he didn't even know the Coen brothers had done that until Milius' own kids went to see the movie and said, "Dad, I think there's a character based on you."
Oh, see, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. I guess that's it. Who do we do next, John? Are you picking the next?
I am.
Oh yeah,
I am. Yeah. So next, I was going to say next week. Next, indeterminate time. I want everybody to turn their head to 45 degrees. Get ready for some Dutch angles, because we're going to be covering the works of Kenneth Branagh.
Awesome.
Should be interesting.
I think it'll be very interesting, man. We're calling, this guy does everything from Shakespeare to Thor.
So I guess invite me back, please.
I guess all that's left to say is
see you next Wednesday.